From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dave Chappelle has a comedy special that premieres on Showtime this holiday weekend. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him. His popular series, Chappelle Show, is shown on Comedy Central. He calls it America's number one source for offensive comedy. Then we'll hear from a comic who prides himself on not offending his audiences. Brad Stein is a Christian conservative comic who used to do the comedy circuit, but now mostly plays churches. This summer, he's toured with the Christian men's group, The Promise Keepers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Emergency officials in Florida have ordered more than 2.5 million people to leave their homes immediately. Hurricane Francis is approaching the state's eastern coast with winds of 140 miles per hour. It could reach land tomorrow night or Saturday morning. Michael Brown, head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, says this storm is far more dangerous than Hurricane Charley.
If you look at everything that's going on with Frances right now, she's literally about twice the size of Charley. She's slowing down and has a lot more moisture with her than Charley did. She's coming into a very highly populated area. I expect Frances to be much more devastating than even Charley.
Hurricane Charley struck just 3 weeks ago, killing 27 people and causing billions of dollars in damage. Hostage negotiators at a school in southern Russia say militants have freed 26 women and children from the hundreds of people they're believed to be holding as hostages. NPR's Lawrence Sheet says authorities are finding out more about who the hostage takers are and what they want.
The hostage takers themselves have identified themselves as a brigade loyal to Chechen warlord Shamil Basayev, the legendary warlord in Chechnya. He started out as a separatist, but he's become very, very radical. His agenda is broadened to include the establishment of an Islamic caliphate along the southern edge of Russia, in the Muslim areas of Russia.
NPR's Lawrence Sheets in southern Russia. The hostage takers are demanding the release of militants who were arrested during a recent spate of attacks on police stations. President Bush will accept his party's nomination tonight at the Republican National Convention in New York City. He's expected to present himself as a resolute wartime commander-in-chief and promote his plans for leading the country through a second term. NPR's Lakshmi Singh reports from New York.
With some polls showing President Bush in a virtual dead-even race with his Democratic rival John Kerry, Mr. Bush will attempt to pull ahead of his opponent with his acceptance speech at Madison Square Garden. He's expected to focus in part on domestic initiatives for a second term, including simplifying the tax code, more homeownership opportunities, and greater access to health care. President Bush is also expected to firmly defend his foreign policies on Iraq and the war on terrorism by describing himself as a consistent leader. In an excerpt of his speech released earlier, the president said he was fighting terrorists to keep the country safe, quote, not for pride, not for power. The Kerry campaign continues to hammer away at the Bush camp, though, seizing on such controversial issues as the cost of war in Iraq, unemployment, and a growing national deficit. Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, New York.
In stocks, the Dow gained 121 points to close at 10,290. The Nasdaq was up 23 to 1873. This is NPR News. A federal judge has thrown out the terrorism convictions of two Arab men at the request of the government. A 9-month review of the case conducted after the trial concluded that there were widespread mistakes in how the prosecution handled the case. NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
U.S. District Judge Gerald Rosen wrote that those mistakes by the prosecution were of such scope they call for something rare in American jurisprudence, erasing a jury's guilty verdict. The judge's order means the jury convictions of Karim Kubridi and Abdel El Mardoudi on charges of conspiring to provide material support to terrorists simply disappear. The government had accused the men of being part of a terrorist sleeper cell in Detroit. A post-trial review of the case ordered by the judge found the prosecution had withheld evidence from the defense and the jury. The judge wrote that, had that evidence been shared, the jury verdict might have been different. The judge also ordered new trials for the men and a third defendant on document fraud charges. Libby Lewis, NPR News, Washington.
The United Nations envoy to Sudan told the Security Council today that the Sudanese government has failed to stop attacks on civilians in the Darfur region or to disarm the Arab militias that are carrying out the attacks. Jan Pronk called on Sudan to accept a much larger international force to monitor the situation in Darfur with a mandate to prevent the attacks. The Sudanese representative said his government would accept such a force, but would oppose any stronger mandate, such as the authority to disarm the militias, saying that could lead to military confrontations. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces Driveway Moments 2, the second collection of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're looking for some laughs this holiday weekend, Dave Chappelle has a new stand-up comedy special that premieres Saturday night on Showtime. He also has a regular series on Comedy Central called Chappelle Show that features stand-up, sketches, and music. In Rolling Stone magazine, Chappelle's humor was described as the edgiest, most racially charged comedy in America. The DVD of the first season is the third best-selling television DVD of all time. By the way, parents, some of his humor is pretty adult. Let's start with an excerpt of one of the most talked-about sketches from Chappelle's show. Charlie Murphy, Eddie's brother, who's a regular on the show, is hosting an edition of Charlie Murphy's True Hollywood Stories, remembering his encounters in the 1980s with funk disco star Rick James. The sketch was filmed before James' recent death. As you'll hear, this fake documentary segment includes a cameo appearance by James himself. But it's Chappelle who plays the 1980s version of James. Here he is.
Drink up, be merry. Welcome to the China Club. A tang a tang tang, a tang a tang tang tang.
Rick's, you know, being Rick.
Come on, bitch, show me your t-ism. Rick James, do something. I wish I had more hands so I could give those t-ism four thumbs down.
I ain't realized how high he was. Next thing you know, he's like,
Charlie Murphy! What's up, partner? Darkness, everybody. Darkness is spreading. Go ahead, Charlie.
I'm behind the bar and I'm serving drinks, and Charlie bends over. I call. I said, Charlie, come here.
Charlie, there's a new joke going around. Have you heard it? What did the five fingers say to the face?
What?
Slap!
I asked Dave Chappelle to tell the story behind this sketch.
Eddie Murphy's brother, Charlie,
mm-hmm.
was shooting a sketch on our show, and one of the conversations at lunch was about how he had fought Rick James on like 10 different occasions. So I was like, what? You got to tell us more. And then he told us the story, and we were like, okay, this is a hilarious story. You got to come tell it on the show. And then obviously, you know, we'll dramatize it with me playing Rick James. And then at a certain point, so we stopped moving forward with that idea, and at a certain point, Charlie's like, you know, I probably could get Rick for this. So we're like, shit, yeah, get him. and the rest is history.
How, I think you had been planning to do an actual movie, like a Rick James movie. How does his death affect that?
No, I'm not going to do it now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was going to be a comedy. I was hoping to have him in it. At a certain point, he decided he didn't want to go that route with it. The 2 weeks before he died, perhaps I'd spoken to him for the last time. And I think one of his major concerns about doing the feature was, you know, how his kids would perceive it. And it was when I heard him explain it, because at first I heard he has problems with the movie. He doesn't want you to say certain things. And I was like, well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to promise that. That's a deal breaker. And then when I spoke to him, I completely understood where he was coming from, you know, because I'm a father.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just like, there's certain things that I've done in my life that I don't know if I want to see him glorified or whatever, or you know, lampoon. Just like for the sake of his kids, it was the impression that I got.
Dave Chappelle is my guest, and he has a comedy special coming up Saturday, September 4th, Labor Day weekend, on Showtime, and of course he has his regular show on Comedy Central. Now, you do some really, your show is so funny. What was the original concept when you first sat down to conceive of your weekly program, Chappelle Show? What did you envision it being?
The idea was that I wanted to do a variety show that was very personal, almost as if like a comedian has a joke book where he'll write his ideas down, almost as if you could bring somebody's joke book to life. And I think we were fairly successful at it in the sense that we do things on the show that are almost nightclubby. That aren't, I don't know, things that I'm not even used to seeing on television. It becomes whatever it needs to be.
Well, it's
one
funny.
One week it was a game show, mm-hmm. One week it's a puppet show, one week it's half documentary. You can do anything.
We know what you're talking about it being like a comics notebook. In some of your shows, you actually set up the sketch with a story behind it, what you were thinking about before coming up with this sketch.
Right.
And that's what you did before a sketch called Racial Draft. And you explained that, your wife is Asian, you're African-American. And so you've had these, like, arguments about whether Tiger Woods is black or Asian.
So you came up
with this show called Racial Draft. And let's hear the opening of that sketch.
Good evening and welcome to the first and maybe only racial draft here in New York City. Folks, this is for all the marbles. What happens here will state the racial standing of these Americans once and for all.
That's right. And the crowd is here to support their races.
Well, Rob, some of the biggest names in sports and in entertainment are on the line tonight. And I'm excited to see who's going to be drafted by which race. Seated behind me on the stage there are the various representatives. And believe it or not, the blacks have actually won the first pick.
Wow, that's the first lottery a black person's won in a long time, Billy.
Yes, and I'll probably still complain.
Man, you. Well, the black representative is heading to the microphone now. Why don't we take a listen?
We need a black delegation. Shoot Tiger Woods.
No surprises there, fellas. The richest and most dominant athlete in the world. His father, black. His mother, Thai. Well, it doesn't matter anymore because now he is officially black. Dave, the Asians have got to be upset.
There's no question about that, Robert. But you gotta think about it. He's been discriminated against in his time. He's had death threats. And he dates a white woman. Oh. Sounds like a black guy to me. Tiger's taking the stage now, and if you ask me, he's looking blacker already.
I'd like to say it's a tremendous opportunity for me to finally be part of a race, have a home. Been so confused by encapsulation and so many things. So long, fried rice. Hello, fried chicken. I love you, Dad!
So that's an excerpt of Dave Chappelle's show. Dave, can you talk about what actually happened behind the scenes in writing the sketch, and maybe talk a little first about what happens further into the sketch?
The idea actually was a guy named Brian Tucker submitted the idea of having a racial draft. Finally, races can stop arguing about who is who and definitively label these people once and for all, which was like, that's the heavy lifting. That was a brilliant idea. So Neil's my partner, I write the show with. We sat down and it was like a wealth of jokes that you could do because it's the kind of thing, it's a very race-obsessed culture. You know what I mean? Like when a guy like Vin Diesel becomes famous, half of the things you'll hear about him is, well, what race is he? And he just doesn't say, which I kind of think is classy. Shooting it was a blast. Because we had the Wu-Tang Clan. We had Mos Def playing the black delegate. And that was one of the first sketches we had shot last season, which was kind of like one of those things where, maybe this is going to be a good season. It set a good tone for the season that we can kind of go anywhere.
Now, you're really funny at doing white people. And I think, when you're white, you don't think of there being, a white accent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I hear you do it, I realize, okay. there's definitely like a white accent. So what do you do when you do white?
I take the rhythm out of my voice. I try to keep it monotone and even. But again, all right, see, I do these things, but I'm not really, it's almost like sometimes I watch old movies and how they portray black people, you know, with like Stephen Fetchett and all these things. I remember watching them and something in the movie made me laugh. And they were like, why are you laughing at that? And it's not that I'm laughing at black people as much as I'm laughing at the way black people were perceived. Like, this is what they actually thought about black people, which just seems ridiculous to me.
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, when I do that, I think, again, it's not malicious. And it's not necessarily what I think. I'm like, it was just a funny caricature of what, you know, what the world looks like through my eyes.
Is there a particular person you conjure up when you do a white man?
Not a particular. It's a composite. It's a composite character.
Of who?
It's funny, man. All right. You know, when I was growing up in D.C. in particular, now this isn't true for me personally, but there's a lot of black people that I know who really had never had any personal experience with white people, mm-hmm. which is weird to think about in this day and time. But D.C. is a predominantly black city, and because of the economic situation and whatever, they just didn't have any contact with white people outside of being authority figures. Officer, Your Honor, you know, if it's a teacher or a principal, but it's always some kind of authority figure. So there's this whole, you know, their experience with across the color line normally happened via television or, you know, or something where you're dealing with an authority figure. So I, on the other hand, you know, my parents were split up. My mom was living in D.C. My dad was living in Ohio. I traveled to both places. So I was in the nation's capital on one end. I was in the heartland of America on another. So, I just, culturally, I kind of absorbed a lot. I don't know, man. I got a pretty good understanding about the culture. I think that all these differences are just cultural things.
My guest is comic Dave Chappelle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Chappelle. His series Chappelle Show is on Comedy Central. His new stand-up special premieres Saturday night on Showtime. You said in one episode of your show that after someone complained to you that your show was offensive to black people, and that person, by the way, was white, you came up with this idea for a game show called I Know Black People.
Welcome to the show I Know Black People. We take contestants who claim to know black people and put their knowledge of African-American culture to the test. The contestant who answers the most questions, of course, wins our grand prize. Let's bring them out one at a time now. Our first contestant is a professor of African-American studies and history at Fordham University, the New York City police officer, is a writer for such black television shows as The Chris Rock Show and Chappelle Show. Okay, our next contestant works in a Korean grocery store, is a DJ, and claims to have many black... How can black people rise up and overcome?
How can they rise up and overcome? Well, can they overcome?
That is correct.
Reparations.
That is acceptable.
This is a rap lyric?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a general question.
This is an actual question.
All right. There's a complex answer there.
That is correct.
Staying alive.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, stop cutting each other's throat.
That also is correct. How can black people rise up and overcome?
Get out and vote. That is incorrect. I'm sorry.
Dave Chappelle, that's such a funny idea for a show. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the writing of the sketch, like what it was like to put this sketch together?
Originally, we were going to write the material. We were going to write it like an actual sketch. And when we sat down and started to write it, it was one of these things where it's like, this would be better if we got actual people and just quizzed them. And we just came up with questions. We just had them.
You actually got
together.
Real people. You got like a white cop.
All those people were real. We had them get us a police officer, get us a Korean grocer, get us a black dude.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. It was completely authentic. And then all the hosting elements were just like as far. Those were like off the cuff, you know. But the answers were incredible, man. The things that these people were saying. One of the things, they're going to see me, so they kind of go for being funny, but all of them were really nervous, and they were all kind of afraid that I was making fun of them. And then once we got to shooting, I think everyone just kind of relaxed and kind of unwound. And I don't know. That's one of my favorite sketches we've done.
Now, you grew up in different neighborhoods because, I guess this was because of your parents' divorce. If I understand correctly, you grew up in Silver Springs, Maryland, Yellow Springs, Ohio, because your father was teaching at Antioch College, which is located there, and Washington, D.C. So you went to schools in these different places, too?
Yeah, I did elementary school in Silver Springs, middle school in Ohio, and high school in Washington.
Were you almost part of, like, different cultures in those different places? Were there different ways of, like, dressing and different music that your friends listened to, depending on which place it was, whether it was the suburbs or the city or Ohio or Washington?
I think elementary school was more integrated because, you know, people were younger. They mixed freely with black kids, white kids. Everybody was, you know, there was no real racial hang-ups in elementary school. And people weren't really clothes conscious because we were young. And then by the time I got to middle school in Ohio, that's when you start seeing alligators on people's sweater and people start getting into, like, status symbols and stuff. And that was the first time where I really started, like, hey, man, I'm poor. And, like, we don't have any money, do we? And then when I got to high school, so then I started getting into clothes. Then I go to high school and, you know, I was gone during middle school. Crack came out while I was gone. So I saw, like, the before and after picture. I had to piece the crack epidemic together. Like, I remember my first day of high school, and they were like, all right, look, if you have a pager on in school, then there's immediate grounds for suspension because we all know what that means. I was in the back like, I don't know what that means. And then, of course, I figured out that And then I was also trying to figure out how everyone had all this, like, gold and expensive stuff. And then I was like, oh, okay, everybody's selling drugs. I knew so many people in the beginning, like my freshman year of high school, that was selling drugs. I can't even imagine how many people were using them. You know, the crack epidemic was crazy, man. And I think a lot of the stuff that I did in my act, just coming from Ohio and then going straight back to D.C. during the crack epidemic, I think that all the inequities were just underlined.
So how did you change as you changed environments?
It's funny, man. When I was in Ohio, I was the first, like, real confident period of my life. Like, I started gaining confidence because for these kids, I was this outsider, and I had to make friends. And that was when I got, like, this huge reputation. Everyone was like, this guy's really funny. I remember in middle school, everyone was just like, this guy Dave is so hilarious. Then when I got to high school and the crack epidemic was out, you know, what it took to be popular during that, I just wasn't willing to do.
Which was what?
Yeah. You know, sell drugs.
Like, right.
If you didn't have money, you couldn't get the girl you wanted, you know. It was a crack epidemic. Selling drugs was like a legitimate job in the high school I was going to. And all around D.C. it was like girls like drug dealers because they had money. I wasn't willing to be that. But it was kind of like that context kind of isolated me initially And then when I started doing stand-up, it was like I thrived all over again.
So when you started doing stand-up and you were still in high
14.
School? 14. Okay, in Washington. What were the jokes about? What was the humor about?
The first act, Jesse Jackson was running for president, so I used to do jokes about that.
Like what?
I used to talk about stuff I saw on TV, like Alf. But they all had race in them. One way or another. Obviously, Jesse Jackson jokes gonna have some racial in it. Alf, my whole thing was like the alien comes 3 billion miles from space and gets a home with a white family. It was the paradox in that joke. Which all sounds corny now, but remember, I was 14, so it was like, well, you know. What else was I talking about? All kinds of stuff. Like in the very beginning, I didn't know that comedians had material. Like I thought they just went up there and would just talk spontaneously. So I used to do the same thing. Which is probably better that I started that way, because that in and of itself is a skill that a lot of comedians are afraid to abandon their act once they get a good amount of time. They just want to stick to it.
So who were your audiences then?
All right, in those days in Washington, again, remember, this is a majority black city. There was no black comedy clubs. And I remember club owners saying things like, we'll never put more than one black person on a show because it offends the audience. I've heard all these things in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was pretty exclusive. There was one point where they actually had a rule that there was no more cursing on our stage, which is like, this is in 88. And one of the comics who was black, this is pretty funny, he's like, look, man, he said, I curse. He said, black people use profanity because we live a profane lifestyle. And then he says something that I can't say on the radio. So he's basically like, if you see a roach crawling up the wall, you're not going to be like, golly gee, look at the roaches. You're going to be like, look at this motherfucking roach. You know, you're just gonna go for it. I know you're going to cut that out, but it was really funny, though. But just the fact, thinking back on it, the fact that there was all these limitations and all these weird issues that these club owners had, in one way, maybe it prepared me for television.
Dave Chappelle, his new comedy special premieres Saturday night on Showtime. His series Chappelle's Show is on Comedy Central. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. By Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. And from Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with comic Dave Chappelle. Also, Christian conservative comic Brad Stein talks about performing on the evangelical circuit. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic Dave Chappelle. His stand-up comedy special premieres on Showtime Saturday night. His series Chappelle Show is on Comedy Central. When we left off, he was saying that the limitations club owners placed on his stand-up act helped prepare him for producers' expectations in broadcast TV.
You know, before I had this show, I'd done 11 television pilots, which was very grueling. You know, it's hard to develop TV, man, especially if you're the youngest guy in the room. And at first, I would defer to these people just because they were older than me and they all had suits on, and I guess they know what they're talking about. But Dave, let me tell you something about TV. People want blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And our research shows blah, 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 blah. Done that 11 times, you know. Each time it got progressively more frustrating. You know, I used to have arguments and all kinds of stuff. And the last straw, I was developing a show for Fox, and they wanted me to change one of the characters arbitrarily to make the character white, because they felt like it would make the show, the word they used was, have a more universal appeal. It's like, okay, you're the universe now? But it was like, it'll give it a more universal appeal. So I quit, because at that point I was like, this is an impossible thing to negotiate. There's no way that, I mean, I don't know, you just can't make TV that way. Like, then how do you explain the Cosby Show working? Or how do you explain Will Smith's show working? And there were so many examples of successful shows, and these were considered flukes. Like, they were successful shows with all black cast, and it was considered a total fluke because of some pie chart this guy was holding. And that's when I was like, okay, there's no way I can do this.
My guest is Dave Chappelle, and he has his weekly show on Comedy Central and now a Showtime special coming up on Saturday, Labor Day weekend, at 9 o'clock. I want to ask you another question about having grown up in three different places, suburban Maryland, suburban Ohio, and Washington, D.C.
Rural Ohio.
Rural
suburban
Ohio.
Suburban Maryland, rural Ohio, and Washington.
Okay, so that exposes you to different people, different cultures, different kind of geographic landscapes, different ways of living. And I'm wondering if that helped give you the ability to kind of stand back and look at people and see what was kind of funny and ridiculous and absurd about all of us. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like you have that gift of just like looking back and standing outside and looking at everyone and seeing seeing some pretty funny things about us all.
Yeah, because most of the people that are stereotyped, I know the people that the stereotypes are based off of. Like, personally, I've met people like, you know, if, you know, I mean, I can remember friends of mine growing up, like, we used to all play football after school and be like, it's four of us was black, two of us was Vietnamese, was a Jewish guy from the Deep South. it was an eclectic group, you know, but we all got along, we all, you know, were friends. In the household I grew up in, my parents were somewhat, I don't know how to explain it, but over our mantelpiece there was pictures of Malcolm X. You know, I listened to Dick Gregory records growing up. I listened to The Last Poets. I mean, you know, there were books all over the house and always reading stuff. So like, you know, like people like Frederick Douglass. I you know, these guys' pictures were on my walls when I was growing up.
You described your family growing up as the broke Huxtables.
Yeah, we were like broke Huxtables.
Your mother was is a Unitarian minister?
She was, yeah. She was, I believe she was the first black woman ordained in that Unitarian church.
And your father was a music professor?
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Voice. He used to sing opera and stuff.
So your family was really very educated and probably instilled those values in you. Was there pressure on you to do well in school and what you really wanted was to be a comic?
I mean, first of all, I was a horrible student. My parents, you know, my dad was very philosophical about these kind of things. As a matter of fact, when I'm the first person in my family not to go to college, like since slavery. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, didn't like that at all. She, at first, because I was 17, I'm like, I'm not going to college. I'm going to move to New York and try to make it in stand-up. And she kind of flipped out. She was like, it's a dream of mine. This is a heavy guilt trip. She goes, it's a dream of mine to see all of my grandbabies graduate from college before I die. It's like, well, I got to bring Diane up, man. And that's a lot of pressure. But then my dad's whole take on it was, unless you want to do something that requires you go to college, then college could very well be a waste of your time.
And he was a college professor, so coming from him, that must have really registered on you.
Yeah, he was an educator. He was an educated man. And I think my parents ultimately wanted me to be happy. You know, I mean, my argument was, you know, Dad, if you're making a teacher's salary, if I can make a teacher's salary doing stand-up, to me, I'd rather do that than teach. It's like, and he understood where I was coming from. Like, you know, it's like I didn't necessarily have to be rich and famous. Obviously, I wanted to, but that wasn't necessarily my aim. I just really, 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 to this day, I really like doing stand-up.
Since you started when you were so young, your mother had to, did she have to or did she just want to come to the clubs with you? Was that required as like an official chaperone because you were underage?
Originally, she had to. Once everyone started knowing me, this was kind of like our routine. We'd meet down at the club. I'd be coming from school. She'd be coming from work. It was cool, man. It was like a good way to spend time together. And then at a certain age, like maybe a year into it, you know, she'd get tired at night. We'd both burn the candle both ends, but I'd always want to go, so she just let me go. And you know, not until I'm an adult, then she tells me how scary that was for her.
In what way?
You know? I mean, she tells stories like she'd hear gunshots in the middle of the night. And, you know, she went, oh, my God, it's my baby. All right. I mean, remember, this is D.C. during the crack epidemic. But I guess in her mind, it's like of all the bad things that my child could be doing, he just wants to tell jokes at these clubs. And it was a controlled environment for me. It's not like the bartender's going to give me drinks. I'm 14. It's, you know, everyone kind of looked out for me. It wasn't like I saw stuff going on, but not really. It was more of a, it was really goal-oriented time I was spending there.
Now, when you were still pretty young, Mel Brooks cast you in his movie Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Yeah.
What was it like to work with, how old were you? What was it like to work with Mel Brooks then?
Well, I was probably 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm.
And I was starstruck. Mel Brooks is a real warm guy. He makes you feel, he doesn't have any airs on him. You know what I mean? I get the feeling that he was real unaffected by his career. He's just another guy. He just loves comedy. And in certain ways, it was kind of a mentor relationship in the sense that I got to watch a guy execute a vision he had, a guy that I respected, and the guy that, I don't know, that was a crazy experience. But the thing I always think about Mel Brooks is he was just such a nice man, you know. Like, me and this guy really hit it off during that movie.
Did he give you any good advice?
I mean, I would learn from him more, and just, like, he would tell these stories, man. He told me about when he saw Richard Pryor for the first time, and writing Blazing Saddles and trying to get Richard in the movie, and the studio wouldn't let me, and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, just him telling these stories just did a lot for my imagination, man, and it kind of inspired me. You know, I mean, for me, like, even when I started writing, actually, that advice came from Eddie Murphy. Excuse me, when we were doing Nutty Professor, Eddie Murphy was like, you know, you should really write because the way you tell jokes, he said, it's like you see jokes in pictures, which is kind of true. It's like I kind of, it's explaining these images I have in my mind. And he said, you should write, man. You got like a writer's mind. And, you know, and I think that's when I started trying to write more, just trying to self-generate. And thank God, because if I wasn't able to come up with ideas, I wouldn't work right now. I wouldn't be working right now.
Well, Dave Chappelle, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
All right. No problem. It was good to meet you.
Dave Chappelle's new comedy special premieres Saturday night on Showtime. His series, Chappelle Show, is on Comedy Central. Coming up, Christian comic Brad Stein. This is Fresh Air. I'm going to let my next guest, Brad Stein, introduce himself.
Oh, I have to tell you about you. A lot of people, if you do not know who I am, there's something about me you should know right off the bat. I believe in freedom. I believe in freedom of speech. And so I want to give you the same opportunity that I hear a lot of people try to tell us all the time when we see something we don't want to see. Hey, just turn the channel. I'm going to give you a little channel turning chance right now before we get the ball rolling about me. You better know it, and you better know it now. Number one, I am a conservative comedian. Listen to me, a conservative comedian, one of two known to exist in the Western Hemisphere. Number two, I am a Christian. I believe that God is real, and I'm proud that that is the heritage of my country. That's number two. And number three, I believe the United States of America is the greatest country that has ever existed on the face of the earth. It's worth fighting for. It's worth dying for, because there's never been a country like this. It's better than Europe. That's why we left. I have found my constituency.
That's from Brad Stein's latest comedy CD, A Conservative Unleashed. Stein used to play the comedy circuit, but now he plays evangelical churches and other Christian events, such as private parties for the staffs of Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network and Jerry Falwell's church. This summer, he's toured with the Christian men's group The Promise Keepers. Last month, he was profiled in The New Yorker magazine. Brad Stein, welcome to Fresh Air. What would you say separates you from more secular comics?
I'm shorter, I think, than more of them. I'm like 5'6". So, you know, I got the short constituency, which is very rare, I think, in the comedy field. But, you know, I think what really makes me different, at least from what people are telling me, is that, number one, I'm a conservative politically. So I definitely come from a political point of view that rarely is seen in the entertainment industry. Secondly, I am a Christian. I do believe in God. I believe Jesus is God. So I have a specific religious belief. I would say also never use a curse word. And also just, oh, yeah, no, like, gratuitous sexual references. So it's a very clean show. But yet it still fits with, you know, the style of mainstream comedy, which is, you know, sort of sarcastic and satirical and in your face and so on and so forth. So it's kind of an interesting mix, kind of like clean comedy in a dirty package.
Yeah, well, you are very in your face. Now, this summer you've been touring with the Christian men's group The Promise Keepers?
I have. I'd worked a number of events like with 15,000 men, so it's exciting. And just to have all that testosterone is just that's something you don't normally get in a comedy club. So and my comedy style really just hits well for men, because guys like stuff in your face and pulling no punches.
So what goes over best with the Promise Keepers?
Well, I mean, the whole idea of what men are, and that we have so few facilities in this country that, you know, are just allow men to be men, you know. I mean, and I talk about that. I was like, you know, women, I love them. I mean, there's no anti-women. Promise Keepers is designed to teach men to be great husbands and great fathers. That's what it's for. It's to give them a sense of their purpose on this earth and their value that they have to give to culture and society. But, you know, I like to joke with them as men and let them feel like, hey, it's a guy's event, you know, and you don't have to, you know, you can go use the woman's restroom. You don't have to put the seat down. I love that. You know, finally, you know, we can be free from that, because that's what I've heard my whole life from my wife. Put the seat down. And I asked her why, and she said, because if you don't want to go potty in the middle of the night, I fall in the toilet. That's what my wife told me. I'm thinking, you know, every time you go potty, you sit. I sit down half the time. I'm not nearly as experienced as you are, and yet I've managed to never fall in the toilet. I'm sorry, but if you have to sit down every time you go potty and you don't make sure the seat's there, you deserve to fall in the toilet. That's your punishment for not using your neck. So anyway, stuff like that.
How come you say go potty, which is a word that people use when they're talking to their three-year-olds?
Well, interesting. You know what? I mean, I guess I just say that because, you know, and this is the interesting tightrope that I walk. Because I'm working for a group of people who come from, you know, very oftentimes very conservative areas, and not, again, not politically, but religiously, I mean, they're not used to any kind of language, anything. I mean, when, you know, you got to understand, if I go into a comedy club and a guy says, I'm clean, that means he only uses the F word once. But in a church, clean means you don't use any curse word. You don't use any curse word. You don't use any gratuitous sexual references. So even though there's, you know, most of the men in this audience or most of the people that I perform for could care less what I say, I've gotten such a reputation of people being able to bring their kids to these shows. I've got such a reputation of people being able to bring people who have never been in a nightclub, literally, in their entire life. You know, to them, comedy is Bob Hope or Red Skelton, you know, Carol Burnett or something. So I actually try to be careful about just simple words like that to be able to not sort of turn these people off. And as much as somebody like yourself and I who've been to theater and know what's out there and what words are and maybe aren't even offended by them, there are people that are.
You know, in one of your routines, you make fun of Christian book burnings. And you say, you know, if Hitler did it, maybe you should be heading in a different direction.
Yeah, well, so, I think that's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah, so what reaction do you get from audiences when you say that?
I've actually had most of them laugh. I mean, this is what's so sad to me. You know, I wish conservatives and liberals just had a way to sort of interact with each other and talk in a civil way instead of these sort of shows on TV that seem to have us hating each other. Because so many of us are reasonable. So many Christians, for the most part, 99% of them, laugh and applaud, and we'll even stand up at Promise Keepers. They'll stand up. They give me standing ovations at that thing because they didn't want to be represented by that ridiculous element of calling themselves Christians and burning books like it's some sort of fascist regime. It's ridiculous. And so they appreciate that. But I also had a guy come up to me and wrote me a little note while I was signing autographs and said, here, read this later, and he slunk off. And whenever a Christian does that, I know he's about to, you know, lambast me, but he has to cowardly walk away. And it always bothers me. And so I read it, and he's like, yeah, you know, burning books was a good idea, just like an axe when they burned the witchcraft books. I'm like, you know, this is the type of ridiculousness that I have to battle. I mean, not only am I sort of in mainstream with this very, you know, with a point of view that is not necessarily embraced by a lot of the people that run the media systems, but yet, you know, I'm trying to get in a foot in the door and say, hey, just let me have a place at the table and let people, you know, listen to me. But then I also battle some of these Christians that, you know, don't want me to do certain things or say certain things or act a certain way, and I just don't care anymore. I just said, I believe that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and I'm just going to go for it. And if Christians are offended because they think that, you know, you're not allowed to have a glass of wine, then that's their problem.
Now, you were born again when you were 9. It seems to me that's before you had a chance to partake of the really big sins. So what did it mean to be born again at such a young age?
That's a good point. Yeah, I was 9 years old, and that's the problem. I mean, I remember seeing, you know, people that would have wonderful testimonies when they became Christians, you know, and it's like I longed for the great testimony.
Right.
I mean, I'd see people that, yes, I was addicted to heroin and the Lord freed me. I'd be like, oh, if I was addicted to heroin, you know, I wanted to have that. I wanted to be found in a gutter somewhere with like vomit coming out of my mouth and say, free me, Jesus. That's what I wanted to be. And it never happened. I was 9, you know, so like you said, just how complex was my world. I was like, yes, I used to have difficulty with long division, and the Lord freed me. You know, I didn't have a great testimony. But, you know, that's true. I became a Christian at a very young age. I really studied. I really read the material. I really tried to understand this. I really tried to live this life. And then, you know, in my early 20s, I sort of, like a lot of people that grow up in the church, and probably in all, you know, serious religious commitments, I sort of walked away from it. I had a moment of crisis of faith, to be honest, where I said, is this real, or am I just following some tradition? And I went off in took everything the world had to offer me and indulged in it and really you know, tried to discover it. But again, I felt empty and lost, and I just said, this is not who I am, and this is not the way I'm going to commit my life. And a number of years ago, I sort of turned back around and decided to be this. And then, like I said, only a few years later did I really reach this place where I realized I've got to discover who I am and live this life because life's too short. And once I committed to it, here I am.
My guest is Christian comic Brad Stein. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Christian comic Brad Stein. On his latest CD, A Conservative Unleashed, he jokes about the responsibilities God gave Adam and Eve.
Adam had the hardest gig. He had to name all the animals by himself. Think about that. Can you imagine having to name every animal there ever was and give it a creative name? That would be hard. That's why so many animal names are stupid. Adam got burnout. Gave out all the good names right off the bat. You shall be Hippopotamus. Big 12-letter creative name. Go forth, Hippopotamus. 10 hours later, cow. Cow, I guess. I'm running out of letters. I had another one. Yak, 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 yak. By the time the bugs got in line, he just named them whatever they were doing. Fly!
Now, I got to ask you this. Your last name is Stein, spelled S-T-I-N-E. Stein is such a Jewish name.
Isn't it? I wish that would be, there's two wishes I have in my life.
Yeah.
If I could choose. One was I wish I was left-handed, because I think that's so cool that people can be left-handed.
Uh-huh.
And two, I wish I was Jewish or had some Jewish heritage. I just so admire the Jewish people. And, but I'm
wondering
German.
If churches are afraid to book you thinking Christian comic Stein.
Yeah. Well, you know, and of course there are Jews that believe Jesus is the Messiah too. So it wouldn't be completely out of the norm, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's spelled weird and it's German. My forefathers came from Germany, like in the 1800s. I know that. So I just always assumed it meant like, you know, mug.
So you never have to like explain yourself.
Sometimes I'm coming into a church and they're saying, Ben Stein's coming! Ben Stein's coming! And it's like, no, it's Brad. I'm nobody. But and then they're all disappointed because they wanted to win my money. But anyways, so sometimes I do have to explain or they're confused. And I've had people come up, and I've had Jews, you know, come up and ask, you know, are you Jewish or whatever? And it's like, I hope so, but I don't think so.
You have a new book, and your book, you conclude your book as the reporter from The New Yorker is writing his profile of you and following you around, the profile that was just recently printed. And your book ends with you describing an incident that happens. This reporter from The New Yorker is following you around. And after one of your shows, someone comes up and complains to the reporter. And you say, there are not many, and they're complaining about your performance, that they didn't like your performance. And you say, there are not many chances for a performer to get profiled in such an esteemed publication as The New Yorker, let alone a Christian performer. Obviously, Satan was aware of this as well and wanted to make sure that when the opportunity arose, the world would see what kind of people make up this body called Christ. Obviously, division is more important to us than reconciliation. Do you blame Satan for
deep?
This guy?
Well, oh, I knew it. I knew it was going to be a Satan thing. You know what? I mean, I do believe in Satan. I mean, I do. I can't believe in God and not believe that there's an evil one, because I don't believe God creates evil. In my book, if you've read it, the first chapter is about not blaming Satan for everything. But
exactly,
I do believe that
exactly.
Yeah. But for everything. I don't say that he doesn't exist. I mean, I believe there is a satanic element, or there is a sense that there's this evil element that wants to sort of keep this message out. Now, that will sound fanatical, of course, to people that don't have this belief system. But yeah, I looked at it like this. You know, this guy found this reporter. He actually pulled him aside, away from me, and said, I want to talk to you. Now, this was in Boulder, Colorado. So these are people that, you know, are pretty liberal. And, you know, he wanted to say, you know, we're not like this. He liked my show, actually. But what he didn't like was, I don't want to be represented like this. I'm a liberal, but I'm a Christian, too, and blah, 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 blah. So to me, it was more about the idea that he would look for a way to undermine something I was trying to accomplish, as opposed to coming to me and just saying, hey, you know, I don't like this, or I don't feel comfortable with this, and whatever. At least have the guts to face me, you know, and let's talk about it among family. And he didn't choose to do that, and so I have two choices, to ignore it or put him in a book. So I put him in a book. That'll show him.
It's the nice thing to do.
That's right. I didn't name names.
So let me just get it straight. You say in your routine that when somebody blames Satan for their job, for losing their job, you say, it's not Satan's fault you lost your job. Maybe it's your incompetence.
That's right.
Right? But
so maybe it was my incompetence that made this guy go up to the...
You think it is Satan's fault that this guy went up to the reporter.
That's right. It was my incompetent okay. comedy material. That's right. You've single-handedly destroyed my career. Thank you. Now I know it's Satan because he's in your place. Yeah, that, you know, that's funny. You're right. I mean, you know, look, you know, this is always going to be the conundrum of the Christian man, Christian woman, Christian person amongst those who do not have a like-minded belief system. You know, is there a God? Is there a spiritual world? Is there things happening outside our understanding that is sort of influencing life? You know, are people who don't believe what I believe ever going to fully come to grasp, you know, what I'm about, what drives me? Of course not. They're not supposed to. You know, a spirituality is a completely different sense of driving who you are than the material world. So I know there's going to become places where people are not just going to disagree, but are going to be sort of befuddled. You know, what are you talking about? What are you? What does this mean? But you know what? It means everything to me. I believe there is a God. I believe that that Jesus was God. And I believe that one day I'm going to be part of his world. And I'm going to go there. And I live my life that way. I'm not compromising it. I'm not changing from it. And I'm never going to walk away from it again. That's who I am. In the middle of all that, I'm a comic. And I'm good at it. I'm good because God said so. He gave me this gift. And I'm trying to make people laugh. I'm trying to uplift people. I do have a very specific point of view. I don't back away from it. But I believe that my comedy is available to everybody, irrespective of your politics or religion. I think you'd like it. But basically, for those who are conservative and are Christian and have never had a comic champion, I'm trying to fill that role.
And if someone doesn't like it, it's Satan's fault.
It's all up to Satan. That's right. He came in and did something.
One last question. What's the difference between hecklers at the kind of regular comedy clubs and hecklers on the Christian circuit?
The hecklers in the comedy clubs throw beer bottles and throw up. The hecklers in the Christian clubs throw their Bibles. So it's a whole different thing. You get hit with like a King James, which is like 8 pounds. Trust me, it leaves a mark.
Brett Stein, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Brett Stein's latest CD is called A Conservative Unleashed. His book is called Being a Christian Without Being an Idiot. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Ian Chalog. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Did you hear him talking
about it on the radio? Well, the next Fresh Air, John Fogerty. He has a new CD called Deja Vu All Over Again. Also, Kris Kristofferson. This week he was selected for induction into the Country Music Hall of Fame. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. I've heard it all.